Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
We made this. Welcome back, everybody, to the Movie Palace. I'm your host, as ever, Carl Sweeney. You're about to hear a crossover episode involving myself and the guys from the 250 podcast, and I just wanted to say a big thank you to Darren Mooney for doing the editing on this installment. Just before we get underway, let me tell you that our Summit of Psycho miniseries, which I've been teasing for a while now, should be kicking off in just over a week's time. Okay, let's get on with the show.
Hello and welcome to the 250, your weekly podcast looking at the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time. I'm your host, Darren Mooney, and joining me as always is my co-host, Andrew Quinn. How are you, Andrew?
I'm always here, Darren. I'm always here.
Like the Baywatch theme.
Yeah. Some people stay in the shadows, afraid to walk into the light. Don't you worry. Everything's going to be all right, Darren, because I'll be there. I won't let you out of my sight.
Thank you, Andrew. That was actually exactly what I needed to hear today of all days, I think.
Good.
Today is Independence Day as we are releasing this. And to celebrate Independence Day, we are discussing a very interesting, very special movie from 1949. It is Raoul Walsh's White Heat, starring James Cagney. And joining us for this discussion, we have the wonderful Carl Sweeney from the Movie Palace podcast. How are you, Carl?
Hey, guys. I'm doing good, thank you. Yeah, happy Independence Day. It's, I suppose, a gangster film. There's something quintessentially American about it. So it's kind of a nice, neat choice, I think.
This morning, I woke up, I forgot that it was Independence Day. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I had to go to the shops. And, everybody is trying to do their last-minute Independence Day shopping. And it was just a real... Yeah, but I'm glad that Darren texted me to remind me. Because, of course, we have our annual July 4th podcast. It's a very special podcast today.
I mean, didn't you get my Independence Day card? I mean, people say Hallmark just try and turn it into a holiday, but I think it's very important to remember this. But yes, Carl, when the pandemic happened, because we're obviously recording remotely at the moment, we thought that one of the things we try and do is we try to engage with some of the people who are overseas. Because, you know, if we're recording remotely, we figure that we might engage with kind of guests that we had on the past who are not necessarily capable of being in the same room. And so to whom that would maybe be an advantage. And we thought people like last week, we had Kurt North on. A couple of weeks ago, we had Tony Black on. And we reached out to you as well because we wanted to cross over the Movie Palace because we quite enjoyed our past couple of episodes crossing over with you. And we asked you what you would like to cover on the list, if there was one movie in particular that kind of jumped out at you. And we had a bit of back and forth about it, but you eventually settled on this one, which is Raoul Walsh's 1949 kind of gangster film starring James Cagney. What was it about this film that kind of jumped out at you, that made it a film that you wanted to talk about?
Well, I was mildly surprised to see White Heat on the 250, actually. I can't remember exactly where it is on the list, but I felt like I scrolled a long way down before I got to it.
it isn't actually on the list is the thing. It entered the list at number 210.
Okay.
And then dropped rather sharply. It left in mid-April, early May.
Boys.
But yes, so it was a surprise.
Boys, we've been swindled.
I feel like I've got a bad track record there, because didn't The Wizard of Oz also drop off the list before we actually recorded our thing?
Yes.
So that's timing.
Let's get out of here.
We call you Carl, voice of the people, Sweeney. Very in touch with the Internet Movie Database list. But yes, but no, you said you wanted to do it. And, you know, on our side, there was a bit of a delay getting around to recording. So we thought we would actually kind of talk about it. But what was it that grabbed your attention about it in particular?
Okay, well, I think it fits actually quite nicely with what I've been doing on the Movie Palace recently, because you mentioned Tony Black there, and I was really pleased recently to talk with him about Bonnie and Clyde for his new show, The New Wave. In addition to that, I've recently did an episode on The Public Enemy, the other famous James Cagney gangster film. That one's from the early 30s. So I thought it'd be nice to do kind of almost a mini-season of gangster films. And this one's an interesting one, I think, because it comes kind of between those two points. It's much earlier than, or it's a bit earlier than Bonnie and Clyde, and that kind of late 60s, 70s resurgence of the gangster film. And it's kind of far removed from the sort of apex of the genre in the early 30s. So I think, yeah, it's kind of nice to see a film that's in between those two kind of poles. And I think it's a really good film. I think it's really effective. I think it's really exciting. I think, yeah, I just thought it'd be a nice one to chew over. So hopefully you guys agree. We'll see.
Yeah, is this a late James Cagney one? Because I like turning this on, one of the things I thought first was, wow, James Cagney is hella old. was that always the case in his movies, or is this like a later kind of career movie for him?
Yeah, it's definitely a bit later. He looks much older here than he does than when he became a star, I think. But he kept going for a long time, I think, into the 80s. So,
oh wow,
no, he gets more from here, I've got to say.
Well, this is kind of an interesting one in terms of that, because you kind of mentioned the James Cagney role there. And it's interesting, you mentioned Public Enemies is obviously one of the films that kind of defined James Cagney, defined the gangster genre as well. He also did Angels with Dirty Faces in 1932 as well, 1938 as well. And basically, he kind of had become associated with the genre, in large part, you might argue, because, you know, he wasn't a conventionally attractive leading man, and he had the kind of edge that people associate with the gangster genre. And what's interesting is that around about 1939, he started to make a conscious break with the genre. He wanted to push away from doing gangster films. He also wanted to push away from Warner Brothers, coincidentally, as well. And this ends up being a homecoming in two respects there. Warner Brothers being a notoriously penny-pinching studio, notoriously tough on their talent during the studio age. There's famous stories about during the Second World War of Jack Warner wandering around and picking up stray nails so that he could sell them for iron, which is one of those great anecdotes that you'd hear. But apparently Cagney had huge difficulties working with Warners because he felt that he wasn't being properly remunerated for the work he was doing. During the late 30s, early 40s, he was one of the top 10 box office draws in America, but he was still being paid what he deemed to be, you know, minor trivial day payer rates. And in fact, he actually tried to branch out and go out on his own as well. Now, he won an Oscar, I think, for Yankee Doodle Dandy in 1942, I believe, is when he won that. And he also tried to branch out and do his own work separate from Warner Brothers, producing himself, sort of pushing himself, trying to propel himself forward with his own studio. That didn't work. It wasn't a huge success creatively or commercially. I think it did a bit better creatively and critically than it did commercially, but basically meant that he had to come back to the studio. And so in 1949, he came back and he did this film, which in some ways feels, as you pointed out, a bit like a late gangster film in terms of those kind of 1930s, 1940s kind of films. And it's weird watching it because, you know, in some ways, not to jump too far ahead, it does feel a bit kind of like a eulogy for the genre. It feels a bit reflective, a bit sort of grimmer, a bit darker, a bit more melancholy in places. But Carl, had you seen this movie before? Were you familiar with White Heat before?
Yeah, Bob, but it had been quite some time. And that was interesting in and of itself, that the thing I remember about this film is Cagney, and it's interesting that sort of the screen time is balanced quite well with the other actors too, but he's the thing I remember. But yeah, it's interesting that you talk about it as kind of like a eulogy for the genre, because yeah, it is. It's kind of made at this weird time. The film was like really wide open, I think, like more wide open than it had been before. Like, there were people doing lots of different things with gangster films, gangster narratives. But arguably, the genre has a bit less of, like, a stable identity than it would have when Cagney burst onto the scene, I think. So I think White Heat's interesting, and I think this is another reason I thought it was a good one to talk about, is I think it's probably, like, the major gangster film of this era. And it's something of a hybrid, you know. It has that kind of briskness and the sort of the clarity of the early sound films, the early 30s. It has Cagney, who's one of the great stars of that era. It's also like a very effective outlaw picture, which you sort of associate with sort of a few years after that. You know, that's more of a mid-30s onwards thing. But it also has kind of a viciousness to it that seems to be sort of looking ahead to where the gangster genre is kind of going in the 50s and beyond, you know. So it's a really interesting kind of amalgam in that sense. And as a commercial entertainment, I think that was just very good indeed. I think it's memorable. I think it's exciting. I think it doesn't really flag. I don't know what you guys thought. And it's got that great star performance at the center of it, of course, as well.
Yeah. I think we're probably going to talk a bit more in the spoiler zone about some of the stuff there. But I think it's interesting that you mentioned a genre hybrid, because, I mean, I would go even further than that. It's obviously influenced by stuff like, say, film noir. That's kind of coming down the line, big success out of the Second World War. I'd argue that you even see traces of, and I know you're going to be talking later in the summer about Psycho, but you can almost see kind of traces of that in play as well. Where you
there's,
have...
there's even a Psycho reference when, like, long before Psycho was made. Yeah.
Yeah. We've had a couple of those. We had a couple of movies that were like, is that a reference to Psycho? Oh no, the movie was made several years before Psycho was actually released. But it does kind of fit in that way. Watching it, it feels at time almost like a kind of a claustrophobic horror movie as well. There's elements of the gothic in there and things like that. It's an interesting genre hybrid, a bit of a cocktail, I think, in terms of genre. So before we jump into the spoiler zone, three questions that we're going to ask, and perhaps they're a bit weighted by the knowledge that this is not actually 1950 at present.
Yeah.
But to kick us off, Carl, do you think that White Heat belongs on a list of the 250 greatest movies ever made?
Well, I'd certainly put it above some of the stuff on the list. I'd definitely put this above Forrest Gump, for example.
So what you're saying is it deserves to be the 13th best movie of all time, right?
I don't know. It's kind of crazy to me what happens with the IMDb, because I think last time we spoke, Darren, I think you told me that Jaws, is that right? Jaws dropped off?
That was truly insane. Yeah. Like...
So,
Jaws went out in the purge.
I think it's possible to make a strong case that this belongs on the top 250. Yeah, I don't know exactly where. I find it hard to do lists, to be honest. But yeah, I think so.
Somewhere in the amalgam of kind of pictures.
Yeah.
There. And Andrew, what about yourself?
I think Voltaire or Gottfried Leibniz or someone like that was wrong when they claimed that this is the best of all possible worlds, because this movie should be on the list and yet it's not. And that's wrong. This movie does belong to be on the 250. And we're living in one of the lesser worlds.
I love that this is what clued you in. It's the fact that White Heat isn't on the list. Nothing else that's happened in the world.
Exactly. Well, there's no reason why it shouldn't be. You know, we almost could have ended up not talking about it, if it hadn't been for our delays.
Yeah.
But at least this world is better than the one where we never watch this movie and never talk about it.
That's fair as well, I think. And I'm going to be
our listeners deserve it.
They deserve our white-hot takes, as it were. Hold tight, there's going to be a lot of those. This is interesting, because I'm going to be the dissenting voice here. I, to be absolutely clear, and to jump ahead to the next two questions, I like this movie a lot. I really love this movie. I'm not sure I'd put it on a list of the 250 greatest movies ever made. I think maybe there is an argument for it in terms of it being akin to, say, what Unforgiven was to the Western. This might be to, you know, the 1920s and 1930s gangsters films, perhaps. But it just... feels a little bit too unfocused in terms of plotting and storytelling and narrative. It feels a little bit meandering. There's a lot of and then plotting that goes on there. And it kind of, I like the pacing of it. I think the pacing of it's fantastic. I think that it moves really quickly. But there's a sense in which it kind of unravels in a way that I'm not sure would allow me to classify it as a truly great film, if that makes sense. I think that there are a lot of really great elements in there. I think Cagney's phenomenal. I think the movie's very clever. But I do think that there are bits that kind of hold it back. And some of that stuff is the fact that, as I mentioned, a lot of it feels a bit unstructured in places. There's also some of the stuff that I kind of associate with the film noir around the kind of the Hays Code and the Breen Office, which we'll probably talk about when we get to the spoiler zone. But things like the amount of attention this pays to things like the workings of radios, which did distract kind of slightly.
I really enjoyed that stuff. I thought that stuff was great. It felt like, because we talked about this being a gangster movie or a bad guys movie. It's also a very, very much kind of like a police procedural. Parts of it reminded me of like almost The Wire or things like that, where it's very kind of like in the kind of like and here's how the police work, and it's actually really clever. You know what I mean?
No, I think I know what you mean, Darren. I think like if we talk about the films we've crossed over one before, we talked about Double Indemnity and we talked about The Wizard of Oz. I think the case for those films being included on the 250 is more watertight than the case for White Heat. So I know where you're coming from.
I mean, I don't want to seem like I'm being overly grouchy or mean. I really enjoyed this movie and love large parts of it. It's also worth mentioning, actually, I suppose we could wait until the spoiler zone, but just to give a kind of a sense before we jump in there, that stuff that Andrew mentioned about the kind of police procedural aspect of it, apparently that came about as a result of Joseph Breen, the industry censor, complaining that the screenplay went into far too much detail about the planning and execution of crimes, because real criminals watching the movie might find such information to be a practical use. So the screenplay was then adjusted to ensure that the procedures that it was documenting were not of crimes and were in fact of the people who catch criminals. And I kind of wonder, you know, surely that's just
doesn't
as handy.
That help criminals too?
Isn't that just as handy for criminals? Don't leave your buddy a pack of cigarettes, not to jump too far ahead, for example.
I think that's kind of a long-standing concern with a gangster film, though. I think, you know, this idea that it contributes towards the curriculum of crime and teaches you how to break into safes and that kind of thing. I think that's interesting. I think that's why, that's one reason why things like the Production Code Administration, sort of one of the things, kind of the factors bearing in on that was concern about crime on screen. So yeah, I think it's interesting that you said that.
This is the New Deal kind of America, where like this is good for police because it gives them lots of work to do by giving criminals lots of ideas and getting the, you know, economy back going again.
At the free market of crime, just keeping it moving, keeping it liquid.
Exactly. You can't have a large police force without sufficient crime.
It's just supply and demand. Yeah. Really. It is worth noting as well, the film generated its own whiff of moral panic as well. There's a really great quote from Bosley Crowther, who I think we've discussed quite a few times recently when talking about these classic films. He was a film critic for the New York Times. And was prone to occasional bouts of moralism. So here is the opening paragraph of his review of White Heat, and it's glorious. Warner Brothers weren't kidding when they put the title White Heat on the new James Cagney picture, which came to the Strand yesterday. They might have gone several points higher in the verbal caloric scale and still have understated the thermal intensity of this film. For the simple fact is that Mr. Cagney has made his return to a gangster role in one of the most explosive pictures that he or anyone has ever played. If it is inviting information to the cohorts of thriller fans, whose eagerness this reviewer can readily understand, let us soberly warn that White Heat is also a cruelly vicious film, and its impact upon the emotions of the unstable or impressionable is incalculable.
That's good stuff. I mean, I know also that the Catholic Legion of Decency said that the film was objectionable in part because of the violence. But I get the sense that's not the worst they could have said. So, you know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You never can guess what the Catholic League of Decency is going to. Nobody expects the Catholic League of Decency. Are there three weapons? Decency, Catholicism, and censorship. And devotion to the Pope. The four. sorry.
the four tenets of the Catholic League of Decency. Welcome to the Catholic League of Decency podcast. But yes, and then second question, Carl.
Okay.
Would this be on your own personal 250? So your 250 favorite films. So if you were pooling a list of classic cinema and you're only allowed 250 items, would this be on there?
I mean, the problem with answering that is, like, I really like films, you know, and like there are a lot of great films I'd like to put on the list. So I think if White Heat got on there, and I'm not sure it would, but it would probably be in the like kind of 200 to 250 range. So maybe. I'm not sure though.
Okay. And Andrew.
Yeah, especially these days, like it gives people ideas of what to do, kind of, you know, when they're at home. Like kind of stewing. It's a very it's a very topical movie, because I mean, not to spoil anything too much, but there's a lot of cocooning, and yeah, so yeah, no. In all seriousness, though, I will be planning crimes based on this movie, and I did enjoy it quite a lot.
I also really, really enjoyed it. Not sure it'd be on my own personal 250, but again, keep in mind, I'm almost ashamed to say I only just watched it for this podcast. So this is the first and second time that I've watched the movie. So I'm, you know, still acclimatizing to my thoughts on it as well. And then final
question. I am twice as ashamed as you are.
Or precisely one half. I'm not sure how we measure these things.
For I've only seen it once.
And then kind of to bring us into the spoiler zone, final question, Carl.
Yep.
If listeners have not seen White Heat, so if they haven't had a chance to watch it yet, would you recommend that they pause the podcast, stay indoors, possibly with their wife, mother, some associates of various reputes, yeah, and watch this, stream this to their television?
Stay alert, isn't that the thing now? Well, sorry, this is going to age the podcast.
I mean,
it's July 4th.
I would certainly, happy Independence Day. I would certainly recommend people do that. I mean, what have they got to lose, Darren? You know, I think that even the most lukewarm of us, which is you, you know, seem to have enjoyed this a lot. So,
shots fired.
I think it's a really good entertainment, to be honest. So, I think it's a nice distraction from other matters.
And Andrew.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I wasn't aware of this movie. Funnily enough, I was exposed to this movie last weekend and didn't realize it, because I was planning I was writing a quiz for work. And I needed to come up with some questions. So I was reading the FT magazine quiz to get a few questions and answers. And one of them was, I can't give it away now.
Well, can you give us the question?
Oh,
okay. Oh.
The question was, what movie ends with the line?
Okay, fair point. We maybe can't give that away.
Yeah. So I had not looked at the answer to the question, but I knew the answer as I was watching the movie. I definitely recommend people watch it.
I love that. Sorry. You got Bader Meinhoft as well. Yeah, and I'll make it 3-for-3 on that one as well, on the purposes of agreement as well. I wholeheartedly recommend this. Really enjoyed it. It's a fantastic performance. It's an interesting film. It's full of interesting ideas. It's beautifully constructed, incredibly tense, and does some wonderful stuff with genre, as we kind of discussed already. All right, if you are in the UK and Ireland, you can rent it on Amazon, on YouTube, on Google Play, and on iTunes. If you are in the States, you can stream it on the subscription service IndieFlix, or you can rent it from all the places that I mentioned as well. We hope you'll join us on the other side of the spoiler zone.
Spoiler zone.
So Carl, what is White Heat about for you?
So I guess, like we were kind of saying, I think very much about, for me, it's about where the gangster genre is at this point in time. And I think one of the interesting things to look at with gangster films is always like, how do they take the temperature of the time that they're made? You know, I think usually they reflect contemporary concerns in one way or another. So I suppose it comes at a very interesting time in terms of like globally, doesn't it? Because I think in 1949, You had like various things going on. You had, you know, you had the proclamation of the People's Republic of China. You had the Soviet Union testing the atomic bomb, stuff like that. You know, so there's something interesting about this film, which ends with this big explosion at the chemical factory, which comes along at this time of like nuclear tension. So I suppose the general point is it's a confused time. It's a time of fear, anxiety. And as I was kind of saying, the gangster genre at this time is really quite diffuse. You know, it's quite experimental. A lot of the conventions are kind of strained and inverted. And yeah, we've seen like the collision of film noir with gangster narratives a lot in the 1940s. And it's interesting, Darren, what you were saying about it as like a noir gangster film, because I'm wondering if you could develop that a bit. Because like there are some similarities, but there are also some differences, I think. I think someone like, I think Cagney's character, Cody Jarrett, I know he meets a fateful end, but he seems a lot more dynamic to me than a lot of the doomed men you get in the noir film, you know. So I think it has some of those aspects, but maybe not in full supply. Yeah. So maybe that's why it's such an interesting hybrid.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of elements of it that are kind of disparate, that and like where it's not fully one thing or the other. In terms of like the noir stuff, I was kind of thinking again that the fateful end, the kind of the sense of doom that pervades it as well. I think it's quite clear from early on that this is not going to be a movie that has a particularly happy ending in general.
I don't know.
Whether, no matter who you're rooting for. Oh, okay.
At the end, because I've played Grand Theft Auto 5 and San Andreas, I knew there was a chance that he could get out of this, even with six wanted stars. You know,
and the police flocking to him as well.
Yeah,
and he had a vantage point. They weren't going to shoot near the gas containers. It was all going to be rosy. I mean, yeah, even things like Verna kind of doing that whole sort of you know, arguably the femme fatale. I mean, she does murder a woman and gets away with it as well. And kind of the sense in which kind of the law enforcement characters are largely, you know, although there is that nominal kind of gangster imposition of, you know, order, the kind of censorship, the Hays Code, the Breen Office, or like, you know, crime must not pay aspect there, a lot of the police kind of tend to feel like kind of empty suits almost. And there's a sense in which you have this kind of sense of tragedy around. You have this kind of paradox with the central character as well, this idea that he is at once this kind of hugely tragic figure. Cody Jarrett is this kind of figure who you feel and kind of pity for, a kind of a sense of, you know, he's very unfortunate, he's very tragic, he's kind of down on his luck, everybody's betraying him, you know, he's suffering from a neurological condition. The film is quite explicit that, you know, he's inherited mental illness from his father. It affected his brother as well. And he's going off the deep end and he's going to collapse and cave into himself. While at the same time also portraying him not in the style that I would associate with kind of like 30s gangsters films, where gangsters, you know, tend to be cool and hip and suave. He's just a vicious little street thug. He's incredibly
unpleasant. Shut up!
He's established, like, immediately murdering two unarmed men because they happen to have overheard his name, which, again, is something that we take for granted these days. I thought a lot of, like, the opening sequence from Heat, where it's like, oh, yeah, one of them recognized us. We're all in for murder one. We might as well execute everybody involved. But there's just a real meanness to him that runs through the film, and it's established and kind of reinforced repeatedly over the course of the film as well. Like, when he promises that he'll get a doctor for the new recruit who kind of got his face burnt off at the, you know, at the train robbery, and then proceeds to order another one of his men to go in and just shoot him in the face. And kind of like, this is kind of your defining character beat. But I like that there's the sense.
Well, he didn't kill him in cold blood. He warmed him up first. with all that steam.
That's very fair.
Yeah.
that is very fair. And again, that's kind of one of those things that gets at that atomic anxiety that I think Carl mentioned there. That's kind of permeating the film. And I think you're right that Raoul Walsh probably isn't a director that you would associate with these kind of commentaries on contemporary society. He'd worked with Cagney on, I think, The Roaring Twenties and Strawberry Blonde as well. Walsh had a very long career as a director working within the studio system. He's very highly regarded. I haven't seen any of his other films, but he's apparently very highly regarded by people familiar with the cinema of the time. Notably got his first big break playing, working with Griffiths, D.W. Griffiths.
Yeah.
Famously played John Wilkes Booth in Birth of a Nation as well. So there's an interesting bit of tidbit in terms of Raoul Walsh. But in terms of that atomic anxiety, there's this recurring motif of kind of heat and fire that runs through it. And obviously why heat of the title. You mentioned the fact that everything literally blows up and you get a big mushroom cloud at the end. But even the opening sequence at the start where he burns one of his colleagues with steam and they discuss the, like, how the burns apply to the flesh as well. The fact that how Cody talks about what's happening inside his head is again defined in terms of temperature. The white heat of the title is how he describes a white hot buzzsaw that's coming inside his skull as well. So I think that, you know, it's not too far to go and look and kind of see the shadow of, or the specter of, the atomic bomb kind of looming over it. I think that Adrian Danks, who writes at Sensitive Cinema, has seen this as kind of a precursor to the atomic noir of the 1950s, films like, say, Kiss Me Deadly, for example, where there is that kind of sense of atomic anxiety and uncertainty that runs through it as well. And again, a lot of emphasis on fire and burning and the consequences of fire and burning on bodies as well. Again, notable that they want to rob a gas refinery at the end as well by sneaking inside a truck that's supposed to be transporting gas as well. So yeah, it's kind of, it's interesting in that respect as well, I think.
Yeah, it's the kind of as well, whether Rao realized this or not, is perhaps sort of more in the zeitgeist. People don't realize these things about themselves until Darren the psychotherapist is able to kind of sit their films down and say, yeah, were your parents divorced, what does the shark represent?
But to be fair, the film practically invites it. There's a psychoanalysis.
It does. No,
how Cody's pathologized himself as well. Yeah. And again, that's probably, I think, one of the big differences as well between, say, and again, you mentioned like film noir, but a difference between this and the earlier gangster films as well is that I mentioned earlier, like, my big issue with the film is that it often feels like a bunch of stuff happening. Like, if you sit somebody down and you describe the plot of White Heat to them without just saying, well, it's about a gangster named Cody Jarrett, you have to go, well, it's about a train robbery, and then a bunch of gangsters go into hiding, but then the gangster turns himself in and goes to prison for a crime that he didn't actually commit, so it's a shorter sentence, but then the gang, basically, one of the members of his gang, murders his mother, so he has to break out of prison, but then he organizes a robbery of an oil refinery, and then it all blows up, which is kind of like a sense of there's at least three or four clauses too many there.
Yeah, well, that's one of the interesting things with this particular film when it comes in history is that, yeah, you're right, Darren, and it's almost like after an hour and 15 minutes, it's almost threatening to evolve into a heist film, isn't it? But it doesn't quite do what a heist film would, because... But I think it's interesting. I think heist films developed out of the gangster film, amongst other influences. But there are lots of like predecessors for the heist. You know, films that have some of the features of the heist film, they don't necessarily shape them in the way you would expect in later films. But yeah, I mean, this is just about a year or so before The Asphalt Jungle, which is often said to be like the first heist film. And I think the difference is that in White Heat, the narrative is centered on the criminals, not the robbery, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, like I say, it's about an hour and a quarter in when it comes up. We're not really interested in the crew as such. It's much more about Cagney as an individual,
yeah,
or Jarrett as an individual. So it's kind of interesting. Like the planning of that job at the end and the timing of it becomes quite important. It's not developed as like a set piece in the way that like a heist film would.
Yeah.
But part of that, I like that. I think Walsh is somebody, he doesn't necessarily linger on stuff. He was very effective at telling stories in a very muscular fashion, I think.
Mm.
But I think to some degree, the film kind of hints at the possibilities of like the heist narrative. And Walsh did another gangster film, High Sierra, which is somewhat similar too. There's a robbery in that where, you know, you get the insert shot of the plans and that kind of thing, but it's not a full-blown heist. So yeah, that's another kind of genre or subgenre we could kind of throw into the mix with this one, I think.
Yeah, Walsh has a very, sorry, he's my friend. he has a very efficient way of telling a story. Like the phone call, somebody picks it up, explains everything that's happened for the last 15 minutes in like about 3 or 4 seconds. And he's like, oh, I thought so. I kind of enjoyed that. I think Darren is right, the point about the about how wooden the Evans is, I guess. I wouldn't say the same thing about Pardo or the name of the, I think I have it written down somewhere. Pardo is his undercover name anyway.
Fallon.
Yes, sorry, you're right. I thought he was great. I thought Evans feels like one of those kind of I love old movies, but he's kind of one of those old movie actors that you get sometimes, and there isn't the kind of sense of naturalism, but there's great hair. You know what I mean?
Great hair and authority. That's like really all you need. Like
No charisma.
He's learned his lines and he believes them.
Maybe we could talk a bit more about that kind of, you know, the opposition between the authority, the T-Men, they're called, aren't they? And Jarrett and his gang.
The Treasury Men.
That's right.
Yeah. I think there's something interesting there. I think it's relatively conventional, isn't it? We've got this, you know, we've got this dichotomy between the outsiders, the criminals, and the authorities, the regular society figures. And I think that's something that's kind of baked into the genre, but it sort of changes over time. I think in a lot of the early films in the gangster genre, that divide is very obvious. There's an underworld where the gangsters operate, you know, and it's separate from conventional society. They're in a speakeasy or they're in an underground cafe or something, you know, different spaces that you can't go into unless you're part of that world. And it's interesting. Over time, that gets murkier, you know, that kind of divide. I think the best example I can think of is probably something like The Godfather, where it seems like everybody's crooked in The Godfather. The gangsters, the politicians, the businessmen, everybody they come into contact with, it seems like. So there's kind of a pivot that occurs somewhere along the line. But it's always interesting to see how that's kind of achieved in a gangster film. And I mean, these criminals in White Heat, they really do stand apart, don't they? There's no real sentimental streak to them that I could see. They're in it for themselves totally. They don't care who they take down with them. Cody Jarrett's not someone you can rehabilitate, I don't think. He has to be stopped. He's got something of that kind of implacability of someone like the Terminator, I think. Just this relentless forward motion. It's like from one job to the next, from one hideaway to the next. When he needs to make a tactical retreat, there's no hesitation. You know, when he gets into prison, he starts planning his escape, you know. And I really like that aspect of the film, too.
Yeah, it is actually worth noting, again, that that's an interesting kind of contrast that you mentioned there in terms of, like, portraying Evans and kind of and Jarrett and stuff like that. And the kind of the fact that a lot of the movie does have, a lot of the performances in the movie outside of Cagney tend to fall into, you know, what Andrew described as that old style of film performance. And again, it's quite stylized. I have a huge affection for it, but it's something that you don't really see that often. And that's then very much contrasted with Cagney as Jarrett. And it's that thing that you mentioned where he is propulsive. He is like a movie monster. At one stage, Verna remarks that you could shoot him and he wouldn't stop moving. At the climax of the movie, you have the cops actually shooting him and remarking, who's holding him up? He is literally unstoppable and implacable. But Cagney's performance is much more kind of naturalistic. It's much more what we'd associate with a modern movie star. It's much more charismatic. It's a greater sense of gravity. And again, it's not just Cagney, I would argue. It's the film itself. You know, as much as I, and again, complain in inverted commas, I love the fact that it does this as much as Andrew does. I think it's great the movie just kind of goes for what it's going for and doesn't hesitate. It doesn't break a step. It just keeps moving forward, you know, with Jarrett, with Cody Jarrett as well. But like, what makes the film special and what anchors it and what allows it to get away with that style of and then plotting is the fact that you contrast the actual plotting with how much attention it plays to the characterization of Jarrett. And again, that level of psychology. And like, again, Andrew kind of mentioned, you know, sitting the movie down on the couch and asking it to think about its mother and playing word association with it as well. But the film very consciously does that. Like, it repeatedly pathologizes Jarrett. And again, point of comparison with Psycho, not only does the film close with a character handily explaining the meaning of the final scene that you've just watched, he was on top of the world and he couldn't take it.
Yeah.
It's like, in case you didn't get the subtext of this sequence. But I mean, you
such
also
a shame.
Have...
it's just like a few seconds too long. The movie. I just want to see, like, I just wanted to blow up and like the, and the credits to, like, obviously this is one of those old movies where there's like, they're not going to pay money for film to tell you who did the catering, so it just ends immediately. But I would have liked it to just kind of like end with that explosion, and not do the psycho thing of kind of like undercutting the movie with this.
Cody Jarrett, he finally got to the top of the world, and it blew right up in his face.
Yeah, like
literally.
I think that's kind of what I'm talking about earlier when I said I always forget just how balanced this film is in terms of like the screen time it gives to the T-Man and so on. And I always think of this as a Cagney vehicle, but there's nothing wrong with like John Archer or Edmund O'Brien as actors, but you're right, they just don't make the same kind of impression that Cagney does. So in a sense, does that make the film extremely immoral because he's such fun to watch, you know? But no, Cagney's one of the great gangster stars. He's very contemporary for his peers. It's that synthesis of like voice, body and motion, I think. He looks the part, he sounds the part, and he moves very dynamically. And I think the importance of sound there is considerable, because when the gangster film really took up, it was around for a long time, but when we're talking about his early 30s sound films, I think the coming of sound meant that things like social class and ethnicity became big factors of gangster films. You know, they became much more about the immigrant experience. And the way the gangsters talk, they have that snappy way of talking, don't they? It kind of enhances their working class credentials, I think.
It feels very believable in this, because all of Cagney's movies, from what I've kind of, you know, got from seeing kind of bits and pieces of them, is that and a lot of these movies in general have that kind of fast talking wisecracking villain, but it felt really true to me because of kind of the character's mania, that is what it's like when you're kind of like wired in that way.
Yeah, I think that kind of vernacular was kind of inspired by stuff like, you know, the Dashiell Hammett type hard-boiled fiction, I think. I think that's part of where it came from. But yeah, the way it works, it seems to, that's part of the boundary I was talking about between the criminals and wider society. So it's kind of appropriate that Cagney's the one who really does that and the other actors don't really, you know. I think he just brings so much energy. And it's interesting because I think when I talk about voice, body and movement, he began as like a vaudeville hoofer, I think. He's in quite a few musicals, but there are also films where he just breaks out into a dance step kind of spontaneously. It's a very interesting type of acting to me. I mean, I think since the old star system crumbled, we've kind of moved away for the most part from people like Cagney, haven't we? We seem to value people who can really disappear into a role now, much more so than was the case previously anyway. But there's great pleasure for me in seeing somebody as effective as Cagney do this kind of thing. I think the film was promoted at times with the tagline, "All Cagney breaks loose," you know, just this sense that he was a force of nature. It always reminds me, there's a story about Stanley Kubrick. He showed Steven Spielberg The Shining, and he kind of had to tease this out of Spielberg. Spielberg didn't go wild about the film on the first viewing, and Kubrick kind of quizzed him on it, and he said, ultimately, it boiled down to he felt Nicholson went over the top. And Kubrick said, the reason Nicholson's performance in The Shining is a great performance is the same reason why James Cagney's a great actor. And to me, I mean, Spielberg stopped telling the story there, but to me, that's about this sense of excess, you know, but it feels like a kind of controlled excess. And what the scene I'm thinking about is, for instance, that scene where he goes wild in the prison dining hall and just starts punching people out, you know.
Oh, yeah.
That feels like a great Cagney scene to me, yeah.
He's like a tank on, like, beast mode. It feels like if the other villains had known, like, that's what he's capable of, that would always be, like, something that they could pull out. Like, their little ace in the hole is like, well, we're surrounded, guys.
Tell him his mother is dead.
Tell him his mother is dead, and he's going to take care of all those policemen. Yeah,
I love the way Raoul Walsh handles that scene though, where you get the kind of the whispers along the row of prisoners. I think he manages to do stuff like that through the film, where just builds in a little bit of tension, like that scene where there's the thing with the message on the mirror, for instance.
The photo of the wife.
Yeah, the photo of the wife's a good example. And the where he sees the guy, they're going for injections or something, and there's the guy who would have recognised him.
Does recognise him later on.
I never feel like Walsh protracts those or extends those moments beyond the point where it's sensible, you know. I feel it's handled with great clarity. Yeah.
And it very much kind of keeps the film ticking over as it goes as well. And again, that sequence is remarkable. Again, wonderful acting and wonderful direction, because you follow the line down as it goes and you see it coming back, and there's this hesitance as if the people who are whispering this to him know that something very bad is going to happen when they tell him as well. And again, one of those, you know, lots of great behind the scenes kind of production stories about the film. That was one of the most expensive scenes to shoot in the film. Apparently Jack Warner, who had his own tumultuous relationship with Cagney and had his own tumultuous relationship with budget, was like, why are we hiring 300 extras for a scene with one line in it? But apparently they agreed that they could shoot it if they did it, you know, in the morning slot. So filming at 9 a.m. and done by noon, basically. But apparently Cagney told none of the extras that he was going to scream like a little baby when he did it, which is why when you look, if you watch their reactions, many of the extras' reactions to that sequence are entirely genuine. Which is, again, it's startling. And again, the physicality of it, it's just stunning to watch. And again, that's kind of why it feels like it's almost a transitional film, because you have, you know, on the one hand, the recognizable old-fashioned kind of gangster stuff happening, but you also have what Cagney's doing, which is something that feels a lot rawer. You know, I'm not going to compare it to, you mentioned, the kind of more naturalistic school of acting that we have now, although I think there's elements of that.
I think The Shining is a good comparison.
And again, it's actually interesting you should mention Jack Nicholson there, because obviously White Heat was, I believe, one of Burton's influences in making Batman.
Oh, absolutely. Like, watching that final scene, I just thought of him shouting down and says, "Hey, Riley, yeah. Think of the future."
Think of the future. Because they're even wearing the same leather jackets. The cops are wearing the same leather jackets as well during the chemical factory raid, which is remarkable in terms of kind of that sort of style as well. But again, it's just this kind of, and it's notable that Cagney always thought of himself as a song and dance man, which is interesting. As kind of Carl described, he never really saw himself, even though he ended up playing these gangsters, he always saw himself first and foremost as a kind of song and dance man. Again, notable that his one competitive Oscar came from Yankee Doodle Dandy, which was as kind of a song and dance movie, I recall, or I believe,
yeah.
As opposed to a gangster film, which is what, ironically, he's retroactively most associated with. And it's again, one of those interesting contrasts between the man you see on screen and the man behind the camera. Apparently, a very sensitive soul. He would write poetry. Although I think in interviews he insisted Shakespeare wrote poetry. I write verses. And what he would do is while he'd be filming scenes with Edmund O'Brien, obviously they'd be doing these really intense takes, be really gritty, lots of shouting in his face, lots of really intense, really uncomfortable stuff. But afterwards, Cagney would read him a poem that he'd written and be like, "Do you like it? Is it good? By the way, don't tell anybody about this," which I kind of find highly adorable. Highly adorable.
Yeah, I think what you speak to there is a very interesting liminal case in some ways, because one reason he's so fascinating is he's able to take reprehensible characters and make them so engaging in a film like this or in a film like The Public Enemy. So you get this sense, and he's such fun to watch, you get this sense that he's bad, but he's also good, you know. And that's kind of interesting in light of his Irish-American heritage, I think. I think his father was of Irish descent, because it seems like Irish Americans at this point in time also had a kind of liminal status, you know, the outside of the Protestant kind of hegemony because of their Catholicism, but they'd achieved some level of social mobility, you know, the prominent Irish American politicians in New York, things like that. So Cagney's persona obviously kind of, arguably, it kind of reflects that kind of ambivalence. So it's interesting to go back earlier than this, in the 30s especially. He's often that kind of ambiguous figure. Sometimes he's part of society, sometimes he's not. It varies from film to film. Sometimes it changes within a film. He kind of moves from gangster roles to being on the other side of the law. You know, there are films like G-Men, and this is where the Hays Code thing comes in, where he's on the right side, you know. Or in the war, he appears, there's a film, The Fight in 69th, where he's this misfit who ultimately becomes this heroic figure. So I think what's so interesting about White Heat is that it's less that he's a liminal figure. Now he's something society needs to contain. And it's not really about the immigrant experience anymore. That's kind of been displaced in this film. It's much about this Oedipal thing, isn't it? Or it's been relocated into the psyche. So I think that's what's really effective about this film. Is it allows him to kind of blow up something that was kind of present in those earlier films, this kind of pathology. In those earlier films, it was much less prominent. You know, here he's allowed to like really run with it. And I think it works tremendously.
Well, that's it exactly, because this is very much a kind of a tense psychological thriller, very consciously so. You quite literally have kind of the pathologizing of him, first of all, by the T-Men, who like explain exactly how it works. It's like, oh, those headaches that he had, well, he used to fake them for attention, but now he really gets them. So he has like Munchausen syndrome as well. And you know, they talk about how important his mother is, as if this is something that's in your Treasury dossier that you get on these criminals. And then later on, when he's in prison, he's like taken up in a straitjacket and kind of analyzed by, and again, literally pipe smoking psychoanalysts, very much kind of the Sigmund Freud school of kind of thought as well. And again, even later on as well, you have that kind of closing line as well that seems to sum it all up. It's very much interested in his psychology, and again, how his head works and the interior of his head and the way in which that kind of is unusual or abhorrent or kind of, you know, non-conforming. And again, it's notable that he suffers from migraines. And again, this is one of those things where, you know, dubious science is fantastic from a cultural context, if not in terms of like actual science. But apparently in 1945, there was a study done that suggested that the cause of migraines, this was according to John Pierce, there was a 1935 study that described migraines as, and I quote, "A psychic mechanism of the migraine attack was tentatively postulated as a conflict between the desire to escape from the mother's influence and a compulsion not to leave her." Which is certainly adds a layer of context to this.
I get a lot of migraines, actually, and isn't a cure for migraines having sex? I'm not making that up. Like, not a cure, like you'll never have one again, but like
will get rid of the migraine that you're having at the moment.
It's like one of those little pink Migraleave tablets.
I wonder what the 1935 study had to say about that, Andrew.
Yeah, I don't know what Freud would have to say about that.
I know what the Breen Office would have had to say about it, I think. I think there's more to be said. We're talking about this divide between the authorities and the gangsters and stuff. And I quite like, well, it's interesting. I think the T-Men are shown as like extremely technologically advanced, aren't they? It's one of the interesting things about gangster films is that there's some interesting implications, because by necessity, it seems like the authorities don't really seem to serve a preventive function, you know. Like, if they were able to stop a gangster becoming a gangster, there'd be no story. At the same time, it's this interesting thing where, like, the conventions of Hollywood storytelling require that they're able to succeed at the end, you know. So I find it really charming in White Heat, you know, that the T-Men have got all this stuff, like the spectrograph, the fingerprints, all this filing, the tracking devices.
Methods.
Like, back cars, the attention that the movie pays to things like full spectrum analysis and again the ABC method, but even the transmitter radio and the idea of kind of was a cross-referencing, basically, of kind of, you know, coordinating the location, which is done in incredible depth. I love that they explain the idea of joining two lines together to find a point with the amount of attention that they do. And it's great because you have like that juxtaposed with the sequences where Jarrett, who obviously isn't party to these discussions, obviously doesn't get the same level of attention to detail that the audience does. And he's like, I don't know how the cops did it. And it's like, well, movie, thank you for explaining the hard work and diligent police work that goes into law enforcement in our local
communities. And I think, doesn't Verna say something like, it's always, what did she say? I forgot, sorry.
Is it it's something along the lines of that there is always a rat, or...
it's never like, the cops who are smart, is what she says, I think.
Yeah.
But no, it kind of adds to that sense though, doesn't it, that they're up against somebody. Like, they've got all this stuff at their disposal, but they're up against somebody who's more difficult to stop, more insane than any other gangster they would have come across. And it's not even just the tech, I don't think. I think the T-Men seem quite competent in most respects, you know. They've got this elaborate scheme for tailing the cars, they find the burned gang member at the outset, they're able to successfully get Pardo undercover in the prison. So I quite like that. I think there's kind of an interesting battle of wits element to the film as well.
Pardo is so smooth. He's great at thinking on his feet. He probably gave himself away by the worried look that he gives Creel at the end.
Could have played it a little cooler.
Yeah,
just turning half away immediately. It's like, did he see me? We're the only three people in this room. Maybe he didn't see me.
I also thought it was interesting that Jarrett, you know, he has this contingency plan. He knows that turning himself in is the most effective move on the chessboard at a certain point, doesn't he? And that in itself seemed to have an interesting implication to me, because it seems like going to prison is just like no big deal, you know. And like when he decides to escape from prison, it's just very achievable, it seemed like, you know.
Just gonna wander out the front door. He just sort of like tuck yourself in the back.
But there's plenty of real life examples of that. Like for proper criminals.
Yeah.
And no prison can hold them, you know? Like we recently, or maybe in the future, watched Catch Me If You Can. Was that in the past or the future, Dan?
And that was a couple of weeks ago.
A couple of weeks ago. Yeah, but there are all these examples of, I suppose, criminals that can kind of, you know, get into prison and get out.
All like the gangsters in Goodfellas, where it seems like being in prison is actively pleasurable, isn't it? Cooking.
Exactly.
It's Club Med, basically.
His prison friends are better than his
actual
outside
friends.
Yeah.
Apart from the guy who tries to kill him, I guess. But
yeah, apart from Parker.
What I was about to say is just in terms of that, actually, what I was wondering, and this might be a bit of a stretch, but I'm kind of in terms of, and because Andrew mentioned Catch Me If You Can there as well, like Catch Me If You Can makes an argument that, you know, there's a sense in which the ground is shrinking out from under Frank, and that no matter how quick-witted Frank is, no matter how resourceful he is, he will always end up getting caught. The house always wins. It's a mathematical certainty, mathematical fact, you know, Vegas, that sort of stuff. But I wonder if here, and again, part of it is obviously the fact that the Breen code is there, and so the Hays code is there, and the Breen office is there, and you have to have, you know, crime cannot possibly pay in a movie like this, so law and order have to prevail. But I do wonder if there is a kind of a sense in that juxtaposition of the incredibly organized, like methodical, like technologically advanced, sophisticated, moving with the times G-Men. And again, you know, we mentioned the atomic bomb and stuff like that. But to Americans, there was a real sense of kind of technological progress coming forward out of the war. Everything was changing. The world was increasingly sophisticated. And you have that juxtaposed with the gangsters themselves, who seem almost like throwbacks. And again, quite literally a throwback in the sense of this being a James Cagney gangster film, type of film he hadn't made since, you know, the start of the Second World War.
Well,
and kind of like, if there's a...
No, I think this movie... I don't feel like it doesn't seem like a movie that believes in the kind of inevitability of things, because things seem to happen sort of quite a lot by chance, you know. There are a lot of cases where there are huge coincidences, but there is a sense in which kind of like obviously it is a necessity that Cody gets away, but there's often such random events I feel like he kind of gets back to where he was at the start of the movie, towards the end of the movie, like planning another heist.
Yeah, but he ends up eventually dying. He ends up planning a heist with a government agent who's, you know, been sent to infiltrate his organization, ends up being tracked by, you know, the feds, ends up on top of a giant exploding kind of tube, a circle of gas. By the way, those things are cylindrical because you don't want force pressure on corners. That's why they're designed cylindrically, okay. Which I kind of like. I was kind of wondering about that. But like you get the sense in which, you know, he's almost, I don't know, maybe it is. Maybe that is a bit of a stretch to say that he's kind of out of his element, or kind of, you know, he's no longer there in the world. Because I think the random structure of the film, and again, I love that I was like, the thing that I don't like about the film is how random it is. That's what holds it back from being great. While also I'm constantly like, but I also really like how random it is. Because again, that feels like it reflects the psyche of Cody Jarrett. Like, it feels like you are watching a movie that is not only about Cody Jarrett, but has been plotted by Cody Jarrett, in that he tends to have this kind of thought process which tends to move erratically and turn on a dime, and is very temperamental and subject to, like, random and arbitrary kind of acts of, well, not necessarily arbitrary acts of violence.
No.
His violence tends to be methodical.
His kind of psyche seems to collapse in on itself a bit, doesn't it? In the sense that he starts talking to his mother after she died, and he starts referring to himself in the third person and stuff like that. But I think it's an interesting characterization, isn't it? Because there are elements that don't necessarily track with that. Like, it's mentioned on two occasions that he really likes strawberries, you know, And I think that was just a really interesting detail, because like, what associations do strawberries bring? It's like sweetness and nature, isn't it? It's not exactly all these other things we're kind of saying. So I don't know. I really like that.
It's a kind of arrested development sort of thing, I suppose. Yeah.
I think that's interesting, though, is that like, I think the way Walsh handles it's fascinating, because like the scene where Cagney sits on his mother's lap, you know, and I think that another director would have done that differently. We'd have got like a long shot or something, or a full body shot. And he handles it quite discreetly, I think. So it never really becomes kind of unintentionally comic or anything. I think they were working well in concert together, Walsh and Cagney. I think they both had this idea that they wanted to do a real like kind of psycho gangster. So it seems like they were working kind of in harmony, you know?
It was. Well, it was one of the things when Cagney was shown the script. Because again, Cagney, you know, as much as we love this movie, Cagney's kind of had a bit of back and forth in it. He likes it a great deal. He's always been very kind about Walsh and his co-stars and stuff like that. But he's also described the movie as just another cheap Jack job and Cody as a cheapy 1-2-3-4 kind of thing. When he was asked about what drew him to the script, he described it as a 5-letter word beginning with M and ending with Y. But he did talk about how when he got the script and he wanted to do it, his suggestion was that they make the character truly psychotic. That was apparently his big pitch for it. And a lot of the elements that you see, like for example that scene where he sits in his mother's lap, that was apparently a Cagney idea. And again, he talks about like wanting to get away with it, whether or not they get away with it, whether they dare doing it, whether they take a chance doing it, a gamble doing it, and it kind of paying off as well, because it's very much a transgressive sort of sequence. Yeah. Because the gangster is this very masculine kind of archetype, this kind of strong macho man. And again, the film literally opens with a train robbery, which is one of those, it's not necessarily a gangster set piece so much as a Wild West set piece, a cowboy sort of thing. Apparently inspired by an actual robbery from 1923, October 1923, the robbery of the Southern Pacific's Gold Special by the D'Altremont brothers, which was known as the last great train robbery, to give a sense of that kind of end of an epoch or end of an era there as well. They also killed 4 people during that robbery. Cody, at least, was a bit more efficient. Apparently, during the last great train robbery, they blew up the contents of the mail car rather than actually escaping with them. But there is this kind of sense in there of like, having Cody as this very macho, very masculine archetype, but the relationship with his mother, and then through that, the relationship with Fallon, which becomes a surrogate for the relationship with his mother, kind of making the character a bit more ambiguous and kind of playing with that notion of kind of stereotypical masculinity we associate with gangster movies, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that you mentioned there that like the comparison with the Western Outlaws, you know, because that's what's so interesting about the fact that this always gets discussed in relation to Cagney's other gangster films, but he normally plays a racketeer in things like The Public Enemy or The Roaring Twenties. He's a racketeer, you know, bootlegging, and this is a different archetype, I think, the outlaw archetype. And the kind of history about that's kind of interesting, I think, if you'll permit me to delve into it. That came about in the mid-30s, so it came a few years after things like Scarface and Little Caesar. It was kind of a response to a mix of things, like the Hayes office was under pressure, there was this real-world crime wave, and just this tendency Hollywood has to let genres evolve, you know, as dictated by box office success. So the outlaw is less interested in, like, the fruits of capitalism than the racketeer. So that's what comes through in this film, I think. He steals money, but he doesn't seem to enjoy it.
Verna says, like, money's just paper if you don't spend it,
That kind of idea, yeah. He's got this, like, nomadic lifestyle. He's always moving. And I think when that archetype came about, that was sort of spoke to, I think it appealed to some of the undercurrents of the Depression era, you know. It's kind of different to the Western outlaw thing, though, I think, because gangsters, they sort of are in this more advanced civilization than the cowboy outlaws. So their misdeeds kind of take on a slightly different character, I think. But yeah, Jarrett's a good example of that kind of figure, because yeah, it's just like, it seems like to him, cars and money, they're just a means to an end, aren't they? He doesn't seem really interested in them as a signifier of social status. That's the big difference with like the Public Enemy type gangster, where it's all about the sharp suits, the hats, the cars, the shiny shoes, that kind of thing, you know. But yeah, I think that speaks back to what we were saying about the police. The outlaw figure had a useful function as the antagonist, you know. The policeman you can make the protagonist, part of an attempt to make sure they complied with the production code. But it does sort of come along with that moralizing you were kind of speaking about, Darren, which, you know, isn't everybody's cup of tea, I suppose.
No, but I mean, and again, Jared is an absolutely kind of fascinating character. And again, and this is kind of interesting when we talk about kind of genre mixing and stuff like that, because I see, watching this, I saw more than a couple of shades of the horror movie in there. And I mean, it's what's obvious with, I think, is it Zucky, the character who gets his face burnt off and ends up wrapped in bandages so as to evoke the Invisible Man. But you have this constant, and again, a large part of this down to what you mentioned, the inspiration of, say, the Midwestern crime wave and stuff like that, and the fact that it takes place in rural California as opposed to in Los Angeles proper itself, or at least a lot of it does. Yeah. But you have these kind of big old gothic houses that are largely abandoned, they're in woods, there's wind, there's typically storms happening outside, which again is something I associate with horror movies. You have that sequence where Jared is wandering alone through the woods outside the house talking to his own mother. You have this recurring suggestion that he's a supernatural force of nature from people like Verna, but also from the FBI. There's a sense of bullets won't actually stop him. I mean, I think it's Matt Sellers-Eitz has made the point that the sequence where he's on top of that kind of gas tank and when it's about to explode, you know, looks like something from James Whale's Frankenstein, where the monster itself is inside the burning sort of burning windmill, and it's basically being besieged by the villagers below, the monster having to be vanquished. And there's a real sense of kind of horror, or at least for me watching it, it felt like there was kind of an element of kind of horror to this, a kind of an unnatural element, a kind of uncanny element to it. Yeah. Well, maybe that was a bit of a reach.
No, I don't think it is. I've seen it compared. There's a book on gangsters by a guy called Jack Shadoyan, and he compares it, I think, to kind of like that ending. He compares it to King Kong, that kind of monster movie thing. Ah. And I can kind of see that. So yeah, no, I don't think that's a reach at all. What do you think, Andrew?
No, I do think that he's not. I mean, he's certainly a monster in the sense that he's not meant to be a person, but in the way that I think what you have mentioned, which is the kind of lack of sort of financial motivation, I guess, or maybe kind of, you know, the sort of like there is something more kind of monstrous about it. This isn't like, it doesn't feel very transactional. He's more of a force of nature. That if there was no fence, he'd probably just steal the money anyway. I'd agree. It's similar to King Kong and other kind of monster movies. You do sympathize with the villain as well. Like you do want, you do find it tragic.
Yeah.
Although there is also a tragedy about Fallon, because I mean the nice thing about the movie is that he presumably gets to go fishing at the end.
The thing is, I mean, I can't say I'm ever actively rooting for Fallon to succeed. I don't know about you guys. I mean, in the real world, I would be without shadow of a doubt. You know, we need people like him to catch guys like Jarrett. But on film, it's not quite the same, is it? I mean, I think that's why the ending is so effective. Like, yes, he's been stopped in his tracks. Yes, he dies, but he also gets the last laugh, I think, which is good. So I think it's a good ending. I think it's a classic ending because it kind of fulfills that generic requirement of this kind of story, you know, as they had to do. But it manages to do it in a way that's incredibly memorable and satisfying, I think.
I was rooting for Fallon, like not just because I liked him, but for a large part because of that scene with Evans, where he's just like kind of, you know, holding his coffee cup, like, I'm going to need you to do another stretch there. That'd be great.
But I didn't really understand what Fallon was motivated by in the specific sense. I get it that he's on the good side and stuff, but I think there's something interesting that, like, Jarrett actually reveals...
I think he likes it.
Jarrett actually reveals something of himself to Pardo, doesn't he? And it seems Jarrett does have some kind of code, doesn't he? Because, like, just how horrified he is when he discovers that Ma was shot in the back and stuff like that. I don't know. I think the film puts you on his side quite effectively because, not in addition to being much more interesting than Fallon, I think Jarrett's much more interesting than Ed as well. So when Ed tries to bump Jarrett off, I think we're on Jarrett's side, or I am at least, you know. It means that when Jarrett kills Parker by shooting him through the trunk of the car, we can kind of understand where he's coming from by his standards, you know, I think. by the code he lives by.
We're... We're not certain that he killed Parker.
he did shoot rather high.
Yeah.
Parker was
he was like, "Hey, how is it in there, Parker?" It's like, "Oh, it's a bit stuffy. Let me give you some air." And I
while eating a drumstick for food waste.
It would be a different movie if he shot like three times and then you just hear Parker say, "Thanks, Cody." and then obviously you need to shoot a few more times.
I was wondering what you guys thought about kind of the violence here, because like we kind of said, there were some contemporary critics who were a bit aghast at this brutality. I mean, the thing is, the gangster films are only going to get more and more violent over time, aren't they, from this point on, you know? It's obviously one of the most distinctive thing about this genre. Violence is kind of baked into it, of course, but I think the level to which that's possible is always kind of regulated by what society is going to allow. It means that they've become more and more violent, especially from, like, I suppose, Bonnie and Clyde onwards, you know. I don't know.
There's nothing quite as intense as that Bonnie and Clyde sequence, to be fair.
But, like, you could argue that's one of the ways the genre satisfies what the audience deeply desires on some level, you know. But I don't know.
It certainly satisfies me. I mean, I don't know what's wrong with me, but yeah, I really do enjoy this. Even stuff like Fallon's judo is really enjoyable. Like even Cody kind of is admiring it. He's like, "That's some real fancy wrestling you learn." I'm certainly not alone. I don't know how edifying it is.
You could argue that it kind of corresponds with society as a whole is becoming more cynical, more pessimistic, confused over time, and the uptick in violence kind of speaks to that, I suppose. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's something we kind of spoke about, I guess, in Catch Me If You Can, the romance, I guess, of crime as well. And even though there's nothing really that glamorous, aside from the arbitrary the mandatory stunningly beautiful women. I mean, we've I think we recently watched another kind of an old movie where we watched I'm thinking the Sorcerer, but it was the original
Wages of Fear.
Yeah,
Wages of Fear, where there's a whole lot of like really sweaty kind of grizzle looking guys, and then like the most beautiful woman you've ever seen. I don't know what my point is.
That's a good point to talk about Verna, actually, probably, which is probably an interesting one. Verna's an interesting character in a number of ways. She's allowed to be quite coarse, which I found quite interesting. So things like, for example, spitting out the gum before she kisses Cody Jarrett, which is an interesting touch, particularly in the take as well.
I think that's I think that's hinting more at a 250 trope, which is drunk driving.
So when they get stopped.
There's definitely drunk driving in this. And I was convinced that that was going to be some sort of source of tension, but that was going to be kind of one of the things that would frustrate their heist, was that their saloon driver is very drunk. But no.
Also interesting that Vern has introduced snoring, isn't it? You know,
yes.
It speaks to exactly what you were saying, Darren, this coarseness. And I think on the making of, on the DVD for White Heat, I think there's one of the talking heads says Walsh liked women like that who were kind of tough, and you know, so it's interesting. The film doesn't do all the things you might think it would to kind of glamorize a life of crime, and I think that maybe extends to the way Verna is introduced as well.
But I mean, at the same time, Verna kind of largely gets away with absolutely everything. I mean, to be fair, she shoots Maw in the back, but it's okay because Big Ed quite literally takes one for the team on that. The Big Ed gets the ironic kind of structure. And again, this speaks to how the movie is kind of structured through Cody's point of view, because Big Ed gets an ironic death of being shot through his own back. which, except it turns out he didn't actually shoot Maul in the back, but it doesn't matter because Cody thinks that he did. I do love the bit at the end where Verna's kind of dragged out in front of the police. It's an amazing sequence because it lasts literally only 10 seconds. And she's like, if I can, mister, will you go easy on me? I'll tell him you'll let him get away because you don't want your guy hurt. He'll believe me. And then when he comes out, you can do what you want with him. I love that Phil takes all of a quarter of a second to go, no deal, lock her up.
Yeah, like that was not the most simple of propositions, but it does not take very long to think of it. I think maybe he had enough of
this case.
And of people trying to wriggle out of it, like the Cody's mom kind of running rings around him and stuff. He's like, get in that building so we can shoot you. Seems to kind of be kind of his preference. Yeah. I think as well, it make sense that that Verna is so coarse to kind of, does it play into, and I wonder how you feel about this, Darren, and I'm certain that somebody must have written about this. And that it's in your show notes somewhere. That is there a gay subplot to this movie?
Yes, this is interesting. And again, this is kind of something I've talked. I was on the Movie Palace with Carl talking about Gilda as well. Oh, yeah. So yes, gay subplots that are totally hetero and absolutely no homo are a recurring motif in sort of a certain style of film noir. And there is most definitely a whole host of weird pseudo-sexual stuff happening here, to be absolutely clear. Because obviously you have Maw Gerard herself, who is the only woman worth caring about in Cody's life. But then she's replaced by Fallon. And Fallon literally steps into the mother role. But the mother role for Fallon, you know, isn't like being reassuring from a distance or coaxing him on. It's like gently massaging the back of his head as he's cradled over and kind of very tenderly holding him. And kind of like,
not disappoint Darren.
Thank you, Andrew. And kind of gently walking with him through the windswept woods of kind of like Los Angeles County together while they share stories and kind of bond on a kind of like a very intimate, very personal level. They're absolutely is. There is, at least for me, very strong homosexual coded subplot going on here. And not only is it a homosexual subplot, but homosexually coded through an Oedipal complex as well, which is like a threefer.
The best kind.
Yeah, it's like a threefer.
Well, I just wish I could produce Raoul Walsh and put that to him, you know, and see what he said. It'd be interesting. I never really thought about that, to be honest. That's fascinating. I did want to bring up Walsh again because we kind of alluded to his status, but he's a really interesting figure. You know, I think the sense I get is he wouldn't be one of those figures people put in the top tier of like old Hollywood directors. He doesn't necessarily get grouped in with like your Hitchcocks and your John Fords. He's maybe in the next level down. I think part of that, it's really interesting to me. He made so many films, many of them are like really routine, that to some extent it's not surprising he isn't always a household name, you know, but just the idea of it is fascinating to me. The fact that he directed over 100 films in about half a century. You know, like Darren, last time we spoke about The Aviator. We were talking about people like Scorsese and Eastwood as prolific, and we're talking about a film every 2 years in Scorsese's case, a film every year in Eastwood's. But I really like these old timers, you know, people like Walsh or Michael Curtiz, where sometimes you see years when they're coming out with three or four films, you know. I just love that kind of productivity, I suppose. I think there's something very appealing about it.
There is, and I mean, it guarantees you'll probably hit a classic just by like law of averages at some point, right? And nobody will remember the bad ones. Yeah. No, it is. Again, it's one of those things that's remarkable about the studio system. And again, the studio system is something that is highly, highly, highly dodgy. And again, Cagney is quite right to be skeptical of that and to have been skeptical of that. And again, to have got into shouting matches with Warners about how his contract was being exploited. But there is something, and again, you see it in things. I know that for the Movie Palace, you covered, say, Stan and Ollie, for example. But you see that kind of like romantic kind of appeal of the studio system in things like the opening sequence of that, where you literally follow the camera through the studio lot and kind of the sense in which this is how movies used to be made. And I think that, you know, you do tend to romanticize what is basically kind of, you know, a conveyor belt system. And we talked about this, I think, a little bit on The Wizard of Oz as well. There's a tendency to romanticize kind of the trappings of a system that was very impersonal and, you know, was prone to burnout and was very much, you know, detached from the individual, very factory setting, very kind of like top down driven, very bottom line, as opposed to, you know, Hollywood now, which is clearly not at all any of those things, but, you know, somehow even more so.
Yeah. Cagney never had a chance to buy like castles in France that he would never visit, or spend thousands of dollars on wine every month, or buy dinosaur bones from Mongolia that he then had to return. He should have been paid fairly for his labor.
Well, to be fair, I
do agree that he shouldn't be exploited by the studios, absolutely.
It's
funny thinking of kind of in terms of like
Now, to be fair to Cagney, he did say, like, again, and this kind of brings us back to, it's not quite buying dinosaur skull level money, but he was being interviewed at some stage in the 60s, and it was like, years later, when I first heard that Steve McQueen was offered $3 million for a picture, I almost fainted. He was a hell of an actor, but $3 million, that's nuts, which is kind of amazing. You kind of wonder like what he would have made if he made it to the 90s as well. But it's worth noting that like walking off from your studio contract apparently came to be known as doing a Cagney in Hollywood speak, which kind of was a sense of like how unusual it was for people to do that. Cagney being one of the most high profile people to do that. He wasn't advocating for millions of dollars. I think he was just advocating for a
I'm teasing.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm glad though, in a way, that he wasn't one of our kind of, you know, present set.
Yes.
Of these kind of the it makes
Cagney's Pussy Posse would be a very different thing, I think.
Yeah, yeah, it exactly. It because what, yeah, it's what makes film stars these days so kind of I suppose difficult to relate to, and so kind of, I guess, open to parody.
Yeah, they don't have that machine behind them though, do they? Like the things I was talking about with Cagney as this kind of interesting figure for his ethnicity and stuff. I think the Hollywood machine very much played that up. And it's not quite the same now, is it? And they don't have like all the stylists, they don't have the very carefully, you know, doctored kind of publicity materials in the same way. I know it still exists to some extent, but not quite the same.
Well, they tend to be outsourced to their own like PR teams, basically. Yeah. It's the actors doing it for themselves rather than the studio arranging photo shoots, I think.
Or marriages or whatever, yeah.
It's
interesting what you say about Cagney as this figure, though. And yeah, he's come and gone from Warner Brothers. He's got this interesting autonomy where they let him improvise and stuff like that. Because we talked about that interesting period of tension more broadly, but it's an interesting time for the film industry, isn't it? This 1949, it's kind of in flux. You started to get these cracks in the edifice of the studio system. I think we've had things like the Paramount Decree, court ruling by this point, for example. You know, television is just starting to establish itself as a commercial force.
Sorry, Carl, tell me about the Paramount Decree.
So this idea that the studios owned cinema chains so they could monopolize what went out, basically. And I think the Paramount Decree led to that practice stopping. So it meant that it ended up meaning that far fewer films were produced. It had an effect on the gangster film, I think. I think gangster films in the 50s, they tend to be more kind of independent productions. They're not big studio pictures anymore. The studios aren't doing as much. But crime films were good for like B-movies because they could be made very cheaply and often
quickly and on standing sets.
Black and white, that kind of thing. So yeah, all that's kind of just starting to come into play, I think, at this point. So again, White Heat's at the kind of crossroads of various sort of factors that are interesting in that regard. I think that's why Ma's interesting, actually, because she's obviously inspired by Ma Barker. You know, we're talking about these 30s crime wave figures, like the Dillingers, the Bonnie and Clyde, Pretty Boy Floyd, those kind of figures. But I think this is after World War II, so like that's kind of receding into the past, isn't it, that kind of thing? So it's like the reason for telling a gangster story at this point is completely different.
All the influences are kind of old-fashioned. I mean, Cody himself was apparently based on Francis Crowley, who was a short-tempered and kind of like very short-sighted, very short-organizing kind of individual who killed cops and received a death sentence. His last words were, "Send me love to my mother." is where apparently his last words as well. But yeah, there's this real sense of it drawing from references that even at the time would have been old news. I mean, your target audience, people sitting in the cinema, you know, the last great train robbery, Maud Gerard, and, you know, Francis Crowley would be practically ancient history to them rather than something current, I think.
I think so, and that's why the gangster film is kind of motivated by these things that are going on in real life, you know, the Capones and that kind of thing, Prohibition and whatever, crusading district attorneys and so on. And it's interesting how that's all kind of fading away, and it's used more for metaphors or allegories, but the structure remains very sturdy, you know, but it's adaptable. So I think we'll see more of that, won't we? I mean, someone like Coppola has been very open about the fact that The Godfather, in that film, he's using the mafia as this metaphor for American society and stuff. So Whiteheat's kind of interesting to me because it's removed from those historical concerns, but not as far removed as something like Bonnie and Clyde or The Godfather, you know? So those films actually tell period tales, but yeah. So like Ma Parker is not particularly topical at this point. At the same time, I imagine a lot of Ma Parker nostalgia hadn't really kicked in the same way as it would, you know, 10 or 20 years later, yeah. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, there isn't a sense at all in which this kind of crime is representative of the society that it exists in. It's an aberration and a blight kind of on an otherwise functioning society, which is a sort of an old fashioned way of thinking of these things. Do you think that kind of criminals commit crimes and ordinary upstanding people don't, which is not true? it's nice in a way, I suppose, to see a movie from this era where there was maybe more of I suppose trust in certainly kind of like in the American kind of psyche, and less of an idea of this kind of corruption having taken root kind of throughout, like obviously this long before Watergate, and during maybe some of the most optimistic kind of 20 years in America.
Yeah, because this is obviously right before the 50s, the era of prosperity and relative stability. You know, you've got like Eisenhower developing motorways and stuff like that. You've got infrastructure being built. You've got a huge amount of money coming in. You've got political, social stability.
I think you built motorways all over Figueroa and 198 in Figueroa. I tried to find it on a map, and there's just a big San Diego freeway there. So you can thank Eisenhower for that, maybe.
For literally dismantling the end of this movie. Literally making White Heat impossible.
He did blow it up.
I love the idea that, yeah, it's like Chinatown. It's like all Los Angeles kind of vaguely film noir adjacent films. It's really about urban development. It's largely like the climax of the movie. It's largely about Cody blowing it up so that Eisenhower can build a freaking motorway through it. Literally like Toontown in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. I think that there is something in there in terms of what kind of Carl was saying about. And I mean, maybe this is just me looking at this and seeing it being more allegorical than I think you guys are. But I see it in terms of being an abstraction, in terms of being something like a, you know, dealing with these issues. And I don't know if Raoul Walsh would have like categorized in that sense. We kind of talked about that. But I think the presence of psychoanalysts in the movie kind of gives me free rein to kind of go off on these tangents. But to be, you know, to look at kind of America where you had this kind of emergence from the Second World War and this kind of chaos that was going on. And it's notable again in terms of Maud Gerard, who's kind of running the family. You have this idea of kind of women stepping into these leadership roles, which again would have happened during the Second World War. And again, huge, you know, eventual development of feminism off the back of the fact that women were doing work because men were away. Now, men happened to be away fighting wars rather than away in prison. But you have even that kind of simmering through, for example. You have the idea that Fallon himself has served in the war, but you have the idea that, you know, that Cody Gerard himself is kind of this explosive idea of kind of American hyper-masculinity. You have the fear of the nuclear bomb.
Well,
did
Fallon fight in the war, or did Pardo fight in the war?
Okay, fair point.
Because I think Fallon has spent the war in prison.
Fair point.
Probably. Oh, sorry. Yeah, but Pardo has the.
But again, you have this kind of sense of anxiety around these things and anxiety in a changing world. I mean, like, even you mentioned this idea of kind of like it being a film that's positioned in 1948. Like, the amount of attention the film pays to the existence of the fence and the fact that, like, I mean, Andrew joked that Cody would probably be doing this anyway, even if he couldn't fence the money. He'd probably be burning the money out back or something like that. But the idea that the fence has kind of figured out that what he can do is he can take the money from the jobs over here, take them over to Europe, and basically wash them there, kind of sell them off at a discount rate on the foreign exchange market.
That's actually interesting, because it's the only sense in which the movie is kind of maybe tipping its hat more at the kind of Coppolan
gangster, where
the idea is that this person is masquerading as a civilian. And that he's also kind of working in I think he says securities. So there's the idea that he is an establishment in finance, maybe, or some sort of in industrialist. And the difference between him and Jarrett isn't that they're both criminals, but one of them conceals that he's a criminal, and the other doesn't. I guess, which is the whole kind of like idea of the difference between criminals who are criminals and criminals who are ordinary people is.
I mean, I don't think it's a stretch, Darren, to start reading this film in that kind of way that you were speaking of there, because I think it's very often the case that gangster films kind of take something that may be relevant or may not be directly relevant to what's going on in the real world, but it often takes it to another dimension, and it does graft on these allegories. So yeah, no, I think that's a good way of looking at it. I did have a good Raoul Walsh story I wanted to throw into the mix, guys.
Go for it.
Well, from what I've read, he was, you know, he's an interesting guy. He's a very manly man, you know, bit of an adventurer. So I thought it's interesting that he managed to convince Pancho Villa to let him direct him and his troops in the 1910s, you know. Someone who was prone to telling a good story and even mythologizing himself. So there are some interesting stories about him flying around. So there's the one that he, when John Barrymore, the actor, died, Raoul Walsh apparently carried Barrymore's corpse to Errol Flynn's house the day after Barrymore's death, propped Barrymore's corpse up in a chair so that he could scare Flynn, you know. But it's one of those things, we just don't know if that's true, but I don't know. Also things like, apparently he was wined and dined by the Third Reich before the outset of World War II. So he just sounds like a fascinating figure, even if he's not that well known, he's not a household name necessarily. I think there has been a biography of him a few years
ago. I think Orson Welles as well had dinner with Hitler, I think. He told a story on the Dick Cavett show about that. So the Hitler was like kept busy with lots of the dinner with interesting people.
That's it, really. I mean, he's just somebody. I think maybe that straightforwardness can be a difficult thing to appraise, can't it? In terms of his filmmaking, I think that's maybe part of it. Like, easy to admire, perhaps a bit less easy to analyze, you know. But I think he's one of those figures. If you looked at his top six films or his top 10 films, you'd think, "Wow, this guy's incredible." I think it's the fact when you go to like 109 films.
But then when you average it out, it's kind of a... But I mean, you just hope that nobody's going to read beneath it. I think we're sort of reaching the end here. But before we do, is it worth kind of talking about the final sequence? Because again, this is one of those sequences where Andrew alluded to it there before we got into the spoiler zone, as something that's often discussed in the context of the film itself, which is that the most famous sequence in White Heat.
Yeah.
If people have heard about White Heat, if people have seen footage of White Heat, being honest, if you've looked at the thumbnail that we're probably going to use to get you to listen to this podcast of White Heat, it has more than likely come from the final few minutes of the film. And again, it's kind of interesting that that has such an outsized impact on pop culture. Because again, I had not seen White Heat beforehand. I didn't have that much knowledge of it. But once it hit the climax, I was like, oh yeah, that's this what this film is. Was I the only one who had that experience? Or Andrew, did you feel something similar?
Well, no, it was a more recent thing I think I spoke about. As soon as he says... Top of the World, or as soon as his mother says Top of the World, I knew that it was coming. And it's certainly, and as we said as well, it's very significant kind of in terms of kind of a reference as well, because I think you know, Darren, that Batman is perhaps my favorite Batman movie. I suppose appreciating that having just seen this now, that was a very, very much kind of like crafted sort of as a reference or an homage to White Heat did endear this movie all the more to me. So it is an incredible climax.
I think the thing about the ending for me is, like, we've talked about how it's this weird hybrid, this film, of different things. It's like an outlaw film, it's a prototype heist film, it's a noir. But that ending takes it squarely back to me to that kind of early 30s gangster film that Cagney first emerged with, you know, the kind of the Public Enemy that he was in, or films like Little Caesar and Scarface that he wasn't in. But just this idea that these people are going to be brought down, you know. There's going to be this element of, like, classical tragedy, moral reckoning. But they get this kind of heroic status through their death, you know. And I think that's part of why it's extremely compelling, because it's just a great kind of send-off for that character, isn't it? You know. I think I love that ending. I think it's one of the best aspects of the film. I think Howard Hawks said something once, which was, to make a good film, you need 3 great scenes and no bad ones. And I think YT is probably an interesting example there. I think there were probably more than 3 great scenes here, but I think the greatest of them all is that final scene.
Yeah.
Really good stuff.
I can't think of any bad scenes either.
Well, what about those final 3 seconds, Andrew?
Superfluous 3 seconds.
That's fair.
what 3 seconds?
just one thing I wanted to add in, though, just quickly, is there's a lot of, like, fun dialogue in this film. You know, like, I think Verma says at one point that the radio is not working.
Oh, I love that line.
And I think Jarrett says back, what do you want for it, unemployment insurance? Just that kind of patter is really fun, I think.
Yeah, it's brilliant. The lines kind of in between them. I think I'm just kind of looking. I like your tailor. How do you like mine? when he has them dressed up in the jail outfits. Which is great, and you wouldn't kill me in cold blood, will you? No, I'll let you warm up a little. And he did warm up a little as well, yeah, because he was stuck in that stuffy trunk. So it's true.
Cody true is a true hero. Words. Yep, true hero.
Did you like the David Lynch reference? Darren.
Ooh, I'm curious.
Big Ed.
I could kind of imagine him dressed in that suit as well, actually, because all his ideas are so big, which feels like Big Ed should probably take exception to that much earlier than he does. It feels like I feel like Big Ed really kind of puts up with a lot from that gang. I do also like that Maw Gerard takes her share as well. You notice when they're divvying up and it's like, don't worry, Cody's going to get his share. That just means that Maw has 2 big piles of money in front of her on the table, which is a lovely touch as well. And I'm not sure if I admire or I'm slightly daunted by how, like, ridiculously unsubtle Big Ed and Verna are in terms of, like, their, you know, we are now bunking now that my husband's in prison, right in front of that kind of that wonderful shot of Maw peering through the window, like something from a Hitchcock film as well, or like The Wicked Witch of the West. I love those sequences, those rear projected sequences of her driving as well, which are kind of, again, surreal because they're very tense chase sequences. But again, it's Maw Gerard, so she looks like she's this woman at the age of 60 with a pack of strawberries. So there's something kind of just slightly incongruous about
She is terrific. I was thinking when I saw the kind of opening credits that these are all mixed. These are all Irish people. but no, Witcherly is English. I think Witcherly, I kind of looked it up. It's although we have plenty of Wycherleys in Ireland. It's a name from Shropshire. And I had the sense watching it that she was Irish-American, but she's not. But presumably O'Brien is. And Cagney certainly is as well.
Yeah, well, Cagney's from Leitrim, actually. The family originates in Leitrim, actually, which is just too far from us as well. An interesting...
Like ourselves.
Close enough, just across the border.
But he's probably one of the last people from Leitrim. Because there's no maternity hospital there anymore.
That's a fair point.
I mean, my mother is from Leitrim, but she wasn't born in Leitrim. because nobody's born in Leitrim.
But yes, and then also worth noting in terms of Edmund O'Brien as well, he was apparently promised he would be billed as a co-lead on the film. This is an interesting story. He was apparently told that he would be billed as a co-lead on the film to Cagney, but he wasn't. And the reason that Warner Brothers justified reneging on that promise to him was because apparently he'd starred with Cagney in some films from the 30s, and Warners were very worried that if people saw Cagney and O'Brien's names together on the poster, they'd assume that they were just reissuing those old movies. But apparently O'Brien was totally not cool with that. He was very, very disappointed with
that. I wouldn't be either. I think he did a terrific job in this. And what is a gay love story without a gay lover?
That's a very fair point, Andrew. Very quickly, in terms of 250 tropes, lots of inappropriate smoking, because this is, of course, a classic like 1940s film noir. I kind of love the sequence where Phil is like reading the documentation with just a cigarette holder in his hand. It's just so casual. Inappropriate smoking in terms of the cigarettes that help give away the identity of the gang, the most literal form of inappropriate smoking. And of course, Cody Gerard himself ends the movie very inappropriately smoking. As it were, because he goes
That's
up.
That's right, and there's also food waste with the
drumstick.
Yeah, with the drumstick and the beans.
And I suppose the chewing gum. We don't know whether or not Verna was done with the chewing gum as well at that point either.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just a lesson to young filmmakers: do not make a movie without inappropriate smoking and food waste in them, because you how can you truly be a great movie without these elements?
Yeah, those are the elements that really unite the two.
Have you ever listened back to old episodes of our podcast? I listened to an early one and we just kind of first time we mentioned these things that then just become these the arbitrary in jokes. It's great. I love it.
All right, then. I think that about wraps it up, unless there's anything else anybody wants to talk about, anything that we haven't discussed already with regards to...
The only thing I was going to say was, I think that in addition to what you asked earlier, Darren, should people go and pause the podcast and stop this film, and watch this film, sorry, I think that people...
Somebody should stop this gangster, yeah. Carl. Somebody should...
I think people should do a Raoul Walsh triple bill, and they should watch The Roaring Twenties, which is with Cagney and Humphrey Bogart, which is 1939, I think. And that's more like Racketeer, Prohibition, that kind of thing. But again...
That's the one where he's a former soldier, yeah, isn't it? Basically, it's and he gets involved and he gets in over his head and realizes that maybe criminals aren't good business partners.
That's it, exactly. And that also has a kind of swan song feel to the gangster genre to it as well. And then High Sierra from 41 with Bogart, I think, is... that's a great outlaw picture. It's more of a sympathetic outlaw character... Bogart's character's got this very sentimental streak. It's one of the last, I think it was either released just after America's involvement into the war or just before, because the gangster film kind of disappears after, during the war, effectively. And then finish off with White Heat, I think that'd be a great kind of triple bill for people, So I think let's give Raoul Walsh his due, let's watch some of his good films, I think.
I also quite liked, I know it's a very small point, but I enjoyed the color given to the movie by Jerry the Bad Lawyer in the prison scene. I thought that was a great kind of a scene stealing performance by whoever that character actor was. Yeah.
And very quickly, actually, the train robbery at the start, which it looks very impressive.
With the mattress.
Yeah, it's a fantastic introductory sequence, but it's wonderful how excessive it all seems. The moment where they pull over the kind of conductor, it's like, we need you to stop this train. Then they shoot him and just pull the cord anyway. It's making me wonder why they needed the conductor in the first place. But even the sequence where when they're trying to get on the train, you know, obviously you have Zucky kind of climbs on the side, but you have Cody jumping on top of the train.
Doesn't that just give a signal to somebody to stop the train?
Yeah.
Like, as in the little cord that you pull.
Yeah.
Presumably they had all those eventualities kind of
mapped out. Triple redundancy. Yeah.
Yeah.
I also enjoyed the lip reader character. I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah.
And the fact that that generated a bit of nice tension in that scene where his fake wife comes to see him and they have to kind of have this clandestine conversation. You know. So I just thought I'd mention that because I don't think the lip reader's been brought up before in this podcast. So yeah.
And you have that kind of wonderful sequence back and forth as well later on that kind of juxtaposed with that where, you know, he's acting crazy, but then whispering about smuggling the gun into him with the straitjacket, which I also love as well.
Very good.
All right, then. I think that about wraps it up. So what we normally do at the end of the podcast is we ask our guests to give a recommendation to listeners. So something you're enjoying at the moment, something that listeners might enjoy. Andrew's eyes have gone horrendously wide. So to give Andrew a moment to think about that and to give Carl a moment to think about that, I'll break routine and I'll go first on this. I would recommend, I recently, myself and Andrew discussed the movie Sorcerer with Tony Black, one of William Friedkin's kind of lost classics of the late 70s. And on that podcast, I happen to mention that To Live or Die in LA is probably my favorite Friedkin film. And off the back of that, I ordered myself the Anchor Blu-ray edition because apparently it's not available to stream anywhere, which is quite disappointing. So I rewatched To Live and Die in LA and it is a masterpiece. It is fantastic. It is exactly as good as I remembered it. So I would wholeheartedly recommend that. It's got a wonderful performance, a young performance from Willem Dafoe going in there, William Peterson being a fantastically terrible 1980s policeman. It's got a Wang Chung soundtrack going on there. It's got all that sense of moral ambiguity. It's got like that sun-drenched, kind of vaguely scummy Los Angeles aesthetic running through there. The Secret Service doing both protecting the president and protecting the currency as well. I really, really loved it. So if listeners haven't seen To Live or Die in LA, or even if you have, it's worth seeing again. And I think it kind of connects nicely to this because it's another sort of like grimy, crime, paranoid Los Angeles sort of film. But then, Andrew or Carl, what would you recommend?
Well, as it's Independence Day, I'll tell you what I've been enjoying recently is I've really been enjoying the Rocky franchise. I've been watching those films with my son, who's 12. I had never seen the Rocky sequels. I had seen Rocky, I had seen Rocky Balboa, and I'd seen Creed 1 and 2. So I've just seen Rocky 2, 3, 4, and 5 for the first time. And I've come to the realization, you know, I really like Sylvester Stallone. I think there's something very likable about him. And I think he's much better than a lot of people give him credit for. I think the first Rocky is an American classic, but I really like Rocky 2 and 3 as well. And then, you know, Rocky 4 and 5 I was less sold on. But I think, you know,
but say for the Independence Day, like Rocky IV would probably be the one you should bank on.
True,
right?
I suppose that's true, but I don't know. I think if you're in need of a good montage this Independence Day, I think the Rocky films are the place to go. So that's my recommendation.
And Andrew,
this isn't a very Independence Day recommendation, and it's kind of apropos of nothing, but it's something that I'm enjoying at the moment. Is Carl might be familiar with this character, Fred Dibner. I've just discovered the BBC archives. I have no idea why YouTube knew that I'd enjoy this, but I do. He was an English steeplejack that the BBC made a documentary about. And it's an Oscar-winning documentary from, I think it was 1979, but it's very funny, it's very sort of sad in a way because it's about a steeplejack who, and I didn't know what a steeplejack was either. It's generally somebody who climbs tall buildings and does repairs, but most of the work that he seems to be doing is taking down these chimneys in Bolton in Lancashire. I guess maybe reflecting the kind of a lot of the closing of these sorts of factories or kind of the the onset of globalization. And there's a real sense kind of as well in the YouTube comments that people are sad that it's not a, in some ways that it's a world that people have lost, or that there aren't really people like him, anymore. But it's a very it's very enjoyable. It's very, kind of I guess heartwarming, but also kind of sad. Yeah. So yeah, you can check that out on I think the, like you can find it on YouTube. It's BBC Archive, but it's available publicly.
All right, then. I think that about wraps it up. But Carl, if people are looking for a bit more of you in their lives, where can they find you and the Movie Palace online?
Well, I'm online on Twitter at CKJ Sweeney. The Movie Palace is online at Movie Palace Pod. And we've recently, so like I said, we've done a couple of gangster film episodes recently, if people are kind of in this home. Also done episodes recently on Some Like It Hot, Rear Window, The Aviator. And if all goes to plan, and you know, we're recording during a pandemic and things might change, but just about to start a little mini series of episodes all about the Hitchcock classic Psycho, which reaches its 60th anniversary this year. So that's what's around the corner, all being well, if all goes to plan.
Cool. For ourselves, next week we'll be continuing our season of looking at American classics. We'll be joined by the wonderful Donald Clark and the fantastic John McGuire to discuss 12 Angry Men, interestingly enough. Yeah, so there'll be four Angry Men discussing 12 Angry Men next week on the 250. Take it easy, guys. We'll be back next week.
Top of the world.
Bye.
Thanks very much, Carl.
Thank you. Bye. Carl. Cheers. Thank you. Bye.
Yeah, top of the world.
Elsewhere on We Made This. I'm in a band podcast.
We also had access to a container because our recording studio is on the site of a container business.
And JP's Kitchen.
And JP's Kitchen. It really is the Pedley Empire. We've got Tony Pedley, the container magnate.
It's like something out of Only Fools and Horses.
On his business card, it says a space technician. He's a space technician. And it's technically right.
It's not false advertising, though, really, is it? Because if it's a storage yard, no. He is technically a technician of space.
Space. Exactly.
Frame to frame.
It'd be quite interesting for people, if they've seen Captain America the First Avenger, which I loved, to go back and watch The Rocketeer, because you'll think, oh, wow, there is actually a lot to be shared between the two films, not just the period in which they're set, but also that general sense of innocent, sort of exuberant fun.
American optimism.
Yeah.
Well. So you've got Howard Hughes in The Rocketeer, that's sort of the great inventor. He's the one that's invented this rocket jetpack. And just the idea that, similar to something like Tomorrowland, in that sense of, we can look forward with optimism, and we're going to use all of these great technical advancements, and we're going to use them all for good. And that's something that I think The Rocketeer has, and I think that's something that shares with Captain America.
The Sanctuary, a Star Trek politics and economics podcast.
Not only were his ideas seductive because of this idea of individual freedom, but because they, in fits and starts and not in a smooth road, they... His words were more or less borne out in the in the ensuing decades, and so the show kind of takes that as a premise, that the freedom of the individual to make decisions about their own time, their own resources, is what promotes, at least it suggests, what a utopia might look like.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.